A smelly start to summer in Paris today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. France is getting ready to host a major soccer tournament and the Tour de France, but garbage strikes and bad weather have tourists and locals alike holding their noses.
They want to do what you normally do in Paris, which is sitting at a Paris cafe outdoors, but you can't because of the stench.
Plus, a writer tells me how much the poet Rumi means to Iranians.
Whether you're dealing with heartbreak or a broken salt shaker, literally, people will whip out a Rumi poem.
And a kid from Bombay remembers meeting Muhammad Ali.
I ran to him. He lifted me up and he kissed me on the cheek. He was the first American I remember meeting.
Those stories coming up today here on The World. So, April in Paris, how about all of France in the springtime and summer? Should be beautiful and postcard picturesque, but France has not exactly been its lovely self of late. In recent weeks, France has faced protests, fuel shortages, once-in-a-generation floods. In Paris, it's starting to smell thanks to a wave of strikes that have disrupted trash collection. And then there's the state of emergency, which has been in place since last November, when coordinated attacks in Paris killed 130 people. One target of those attacks was the Stade de France outside Paris. Two bombs went off there. Same place where the month-long European Championship soccer tournament kicks off tomorrow. More in a couple of minutes about the security concerns surrounding the tournament. First up, though, reporter Adeline Sia in Paris. What is it like right now in Paris, Adele?
Well, Marco, to be just like you and be an iconoclast, I would say nothing says springtime in Paris like the smell of garbage. So, you know, it's not April in Paris, it's June in Paris. And now that we're finally seeing a beautiful, warm, sunny day today, which was quite pleasant after all the rain and floods we've had, you see Parisians and tourists out and about, and they want to do what you normally do in Paris, which is sitting at a Paris cafe outdoors, but you can't because of the stench.
There have been a lot of strikes. Which ones could actually affect soccer fans?
Take your pick. There's the National Railway strike on its ninth day of strike, mind you, and it's still going tomorrow, we learned today. So there are still a few trains available, but the commuter trains here in Paris are affected, which is a problem because the Saint-Denis Stadium you mentioned earlier, slightly on the outskirts of the city. So that means for visitors trying to get to the opening game here tomorrow about public transportation, they may have a hard time doing that. And actually, there's going to be a national strike next Tuesday, June 14th. So that promises to be really paralyzing the whole country.
Wow. So on top of the strikes, there's still people dealing with the wake of those terrible floods. Do you see any residue of that disaster along the banks of the Seine in Paris?
Yes. First of all, the color of the water is very strange, a sort of brown pea soup. And then you see tree trunks floating at the top, which is not something you see a lot around here. And then this dried mud on the banks of the river, sand, and it seems, fortunately, that the city's cleaning services are not on strike, so they're scrubbing all of that mess right now, and hopefully it'll take a few days.
Are the French concerned about how this is going to affect the image of Paris?
Yes, absolutely. I'm concerned about this myself. I mean, I just walk around, and I think if you've never been to Paris, and you arrive here today or tomorrow, for the Euro 2016 or anything else, you're going to have transportation issues to deal with. And if you even make it into the city, you're going to see those iconic banks of the river covered in mud and garbage piles everywhere. And they also fear that the strike culture, everybody knows the French have a strike culture, but this is probably one of the worst times to have a strike for France. The Daily Le Parisien had a headline today, a bit sarcastic, that read, Bienvenue en France, you know, as in, well, welcome to France, with a photo of workers on strike.
Tomorrow is the opening game, but there's expected to be a big crowd tonight around the Eiffel Tower. What's going on there?
There are 10 huge fan zones across France, and the biggest and most glamorous one, of course, is at the foot of the Eiffel Tower. So tonight there's going to be a big concert, lots of major pop stars, renowned DJ. The British Daily The Independent actually quoted a French security source saying that creating those 10 fan zones across France was as if we had created 10 open-air Bataclans and invited the jihadists to do their worst. And they're referring to the Bataclan theater there that was attacked, of course, in last November, and 90 people were killed there.
All right, Adele, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Marco.
There are plenty of reasons to be thinking about security planning in France right now. Let me turn to Time magazine's Vivian Walt in Paris. Vivian, how seriously is the French government taking the possibility of some terrorist attack during Euro 2016? What have they been doing?
The stakes are extremely high for the French government, and they really have to pull this off well. They have added more than 90,000 security people around the stadiums and the fan zones. They've also hired about 13,000 private security people.
How big of a concern is this for the average French citizen?
The citizens are really in need of a good party here in France. People are hoping that this next month is just going to be a way to let one's hair down and relax. However, there's deep anxieties about the possibilities of a terror attack. And certainly speaking to people in the intelligence services and the police services, all of them will say quite openly that the Euro 2016 is really the number one target for terror groups in Europe, perhaps, of this entire year.
So how does that affect some people's nerves? I mean, is anybody you know planning to just get out of town during Euro 2016?
You know, au contraire, as the French say, I mean, they are actually planning to go to the fan zones, which are regarded as perhaps the most vulnerable to an attack. You have this quite gorgeous fan zone right at the foot of the Eiffel Tower in the middle of Paris. And I think many, many people are planning to go and picnic or have some beers and just relax and watch the game. So it's going to be a wonderful occasion if there is no attack, of course.
And then there is the Tour de France, which actually overlaps with Euro 2016 for about 10 days in early July. And we've been hearing about the possibility, Vivian, of an upcoming strike by municipal police all over France. How real is that?
There's every likelihood that there will, in fact, be a national strike of some kind during the Tour de France, which winds its way right through the country and ends up in Paris, in the capital.
That's a lot of potential soft targets because Tour de France, the most watched spectator event in the world. Meantime, police are thinking about striking. How difficult has it been for the French government to give a sense that it's doing enough to protect?
Well, the problem with the attacks is not so much that the tournament itself might be a target. While the stadiums and the fan zones are pretty well locked down, some terror groups might take the opportunity to use this period in order to mount an attack. And in fact, ISIS pretty much admitted that it was planning to do so. So as you can imagine, if there is attack anywhere in France during this time, the police really already have their hands full trying to secure the soccer and the Tour de France. If there is an attack on top of that, it could be really a disaster for the country.
Visually, as we've heard, Paris is really a mess after the floods and all that heavy rain. The optics of a disaster zone must not be helping things.
If the government is able to pull off the next month without any violence, without a terrorist attack, or for that matter, a violent clash on the streets with police and protesters or union activists, then this really could be a great moment for the country and perhaps a time for the government to finally kind of turn the page after a year of terrorism and protests and try to get tourists back in the country and, in a sense, kind of move forward.
A great big national exhale if that happens. Time magazine's Vivian Walt in Paris, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
We've talked about diversity in movies a lot on the show, specifically whitewashing. You know, white actors getting cast in ethnic roles, whether it's Swedish-American actor Warner Oland playing Charlie Chan years ago or Emma Stone playing a Chinese Hawaiian last year in the movie Aloha. The latest case of whitewashing is unfolding as I speak. Word got out earlier this week that David Franzoni and producer Stephen Joel Brown are making a biopic about the iconic Persian poet Rumi. And they say they're looking to cast Leonardo DiCaprio to play Rumi. I have Marjan Kamali here to tell us more. She's author of a novel called Together Tea about Iranian Americans, and she teaches writing at Boston University. Welcome, Marjan.
Thank you.
You were born to Iranian parents in Turkey. What does Rumi mean to you?
I think for a lot of Iranians, Rumi means everything. He's our pride. When you're growing up Iranian, no matter where you are, Rumi is kind of a part of your daily life. And that's not so much because you read his poems. It's because his poetry is recited by the elders at almost any given moment. Whether you're dealing with heartbreak or a broken salt shaker, literally, people will whip out a Rumi poem.
And what year? What years was he living? What centuries are we talking here?
So he was born in 1207. So we're talking about the 13th century,
right?
Which is a really long time ago, and yet he is a part of our lives today.
And what about yourself, Marjan? Today, I mean, when do you kind of bring out a Rumi poem? Like, what occasions?
So, to be honest, I'm not like my parents or grandparents where his poems are, you know, at the tip of my tongue at any given moment. They are not. I sort of went to him more in college where, because he's part of the mystic tradition and Sufism and, you know, college is a time when a lot of people turn to that. And I read a lot of the translations. So I read his poetry in English as needed. You know, I wouldn't say daily, but he's a part of my life. And I know that for the rest of my life, I'll be reading him. But I'll tell you, my dad's biggest sorrow is that I am not reading him in Farsi.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the team behind the Rumi movie is also considering Robert Downey Jr. as Rumi's teacher and lover. Ironically, Downey had his own farcical take, a brilliant farcical take on whitewashing in Tropic Thunder. You tweeted yesterday, "As a Persian girl, I was brought up on Rumi poetry, and every time I imagined what he looked like, I thought of Leonardo DiCaprio, of course."
Yeah,
I detect a little sarcasm there.
Yeah, just a tad. I mean, here's the thing. Those of us who lived in Iran as children during the Iran-Iraq War and who then left basically see the U.S. as a place of escape and opportunity, and I think we have a gratitude complex. So I'll be honest with you, when I found out that this movie was being made, my first reaction was, wow, oh my God, we're finally going to be represented in a way other than, you know, as terrorists. But then when you sit down and think about it and then you see Leonardo DiCaprio, it just feels like, you know, in 1957, they made a movie about Omar Khayyam, and I believe it was Cornel Wilde who played him. And you just think...
Remind us who Omar Khayyam is.
So he was the ancient Persian poet born in the 11th century.
Right.
Another popular...
Another one of the
and still
great
on the
idols.
Tips of the tongues of everyone, yeah. You just feel, haven't we sort of come further? Not to take away from Mr. DiCaprio, because I'm sure he would do a great job, but, you know, it's complicated.
Do we have any sense of what Rumi looked like and who would be a good fit, you think, to play him?
Well, there are, you know, illustrations that have been posted. And
I mean, he's a man with a white beard.
Yeah. I don't even know if you need to look like him to play him, honestly.
Right.
I'll tell you what my dad said when he found out about Leonardo DiCaprio. It's not so much that he wouldn't look like him, because for all we know, maybe he does look like him. You know, it's hard. Iranians kind of come in all shades. But he said to me, how could you play him if you don't read the poems in Farsi? So that's perhaps asking a bit much, but there's this sense that he's almost like sacred, and to do him justice, and I know the filmmakers are traveling and trying very hard to research this film, but to do him justice, it's not just like playing, you know, another character. You have to get it.
Author Marjan Kamali telling us about Rumi and the new movie that's being made about him, which may or may not star Leonardo DiCaprio. Marjan, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. Tomorrow, dignitaries and celebrities will be in Louisville, Kentucky, to attend a memorial service for Muhammad Ali. It'll be a poignant ceremony, 1 week since the greatest died. But today, there was another service for Ali in Louisville, an Islamic prayer service. Thousands of Muslims showed up to pray together for the champ, a man who never shied away from talking about his faith. Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
The Muslim funeral service is called Janaza in Arabic, and the one for Muhammad Ali was held in Louisville's Freedom Hall. It's the same venue where, way back in 1961, the man named Cassius Clay won a string of his early fights. Today, thousands of people stood together to pray and bid farewell to the man they called the People's Champion. Ali was a religious man. Islam was his strength. the Muslim scholar Sherman Jackson told those in attendance. And Jackson went on to say that Ali also did a lot for Islam, especially here in America.
Ali did more to normalize Islam in this country than perhaps any other Muslim in the history of the United States. Ali put the question of whether a person can be a Muslim and American to rest. Indeed, he KO'd that question.
With all the accolades for Ali this week, it's easy to forget just how much mainstream white America was not okay with this man back in the 60s. Listen to this bit from a 1968 TV interview taken from an online documentary. This is after Ali was stripped of his heavyweight title and banned from professional boxing for refusing to serve in Vietnam. Here's how Ali introduced himself to the host.
I am a minister of the religion of Islam, also.
A professional fighter and a minister as well.
Yes, sir.
And here's how co-host David Susskind laid into Ali.
Well, I don't know where to begin. I find nothing amusing or interesting or tolerable about this man. He's a disgrace to his country, his race, and what he laughingly describes as his profession. He is a convicted felon in the United States. He has been found guilty. He is out on bail. He will inevitably go to prison, as well he should. He's a simplistic fool and a pawn.
Ali never did go to jail, and he didn't back down, period. Not in the ring, and not from criticism about his political views or his faith. Here's a scene of Ali getting into it with white college students in the late 1960s over his opposition to the Vietnam War.
You my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Some of the same things that made Ali unpopular in the U.S. helped boost his global reputation, and not just as a boxer.
I grew up in Iran, and Muhammad Ali was the only Muslim in the Western Hemisphere that I was aware of.
Omid Safi is an Islamic scholar at Duke University.
You know, there's a phrase that I use now, and a few other people have also been using it for some time, is that we speak about being unapologetically Muslim. And I think in Ali's case, I would also say unapologetically black and unapologetically radical in the sense of being a critic of racism and militarism. And Ali was all of these things at the same time.
Safi says Ali's own story parallels a larger one of Muslims in America. Up until 1970, most Muslims in the U.S. were part of the Nation of Islam, an African-American movement. But Ali broke with the Nation of Islam and moved toward mainstream Sunni Islam as it's practiced around the world. Ali never stopped speaking up for his beliefs. After the September 11th attacks, though he suffered from the effects of Parkinson's disease, Ali went on television to say that those responsible did not represent true Islam. More recently, Ali responded to Donald Trump's proposed ban on Muslims entering the U.S. He issued a statement describing himself as someone who has never been accused of political correctness. It said, "Our political leaders should use their position to bring understanding about the religion of Islam." And it said that, quote, "misguided murderers have perverted people's views on what Islam really is." Today's funeral service was attended by people of many faiths, as Muhammad Ali wanted. In accordance with Islamic tradition, the champ's body was washed, anointed, and wrapped with simple pieces of fabric. The presiding imam said Ali planned everything, and he wanted it to be a teaching moment. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
Muhammad Ali touched many lives around the globe, including that of Matai Chacko. He lives in Berkeley, California, but he grew up in India.
I was 5 years old when Muhammad Ali came to Bombay, which is now Mumbai, and he had an exhibition against an Indian boxer. My father, my brother, and I were in the outdoor stands, along with thousands of others. And when the first bell rang, Ali came out dancing. The Indian boxer, however, he didn't move. He seemed stuck to the corner. And even from the stands, we could see that he was scared. Some laughed because it was such a surprise, but it made sense. Ali's fists were lethal. But we could also see Ali was gesturing and talking. He was so far away, no one knew what he was saying. We don't even know if the two boxers spoke a common language, but Ali's arms kept encouraging his opponent to come in. Finally, our boxer threw a punch, and it wasn't clear whether it landed, but Ali went reeling, sprawling onto the canvas as if he'd been hit by a brick. Over and over, he kept falling down from the punches, and to heighten the drama, Ali would pull himself up by the ropes. We roared with laughter. Throughout the exhibition, we saw the footwork that made Ali almost invincible. He'd unleash a flurry of punches to show the speed of his hands, but somehow he never knocked over his opponent. And without words, we saw kindness, a sense of mischief, and humility. After the fight, people stood in line to meet him, and he sat on a chair in a corner of a room. And normally you wouldn't approach somebody who pummels people for a living, but I ran to him. I can't even explain why. He lifted me up and he kissed me on the cheek. He was the first American I remember meeting. As a child, I could see that he was a loving man, but as I grew and learned, it's the path he took that really made me marvel at what happened that day in Bombay. It was only later that I learned that he was a descendant of slaves, that he grew up in a dehumanizing Jim Crow South, that 4 years of his boxing prime were taken from him because he objected to war, and that he'd been pilloried for his faith. He could have been scarred and bitter. Instead, he came out shining, responding with humanity and righteousness. On that day in Bombay, Ali, the world's greatest fighter, became for me a symbol of love.
Matai Chacko recalling the day in 1980 when he met Muhammad Ali in India. He now lives in Berkeley, California. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Colombian Noel Petro is a real showman. He plays guitar, he fights bulls, and as he told this reporter, sometimes things get confusing.
I've been gored, and I played with a crack in my head and 3 loose ribs, but he's laughing when he's saying all of this.
Oh yeah, and wait till you hear his donkey impression. That's all ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've reported a lot in the past year on Lesbos and how that Greek island has been overwhelmed by the arrival of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees. But let's not forget the tiny Italian island of Lampedusa. It's been experiencing something similar for the last 2 decades. Lampedusa sits on what's been called the deadliest migration route in the Mediterranean, roughly halfway between Sicily and North Africa. Thousands have died en route over the years when their crowded boats sink. Those lucky enough to be rescued are taken to Lampedusa for processing. That makes the island a front line in Europe's long-running migrant crisis. Italian filmmaker Gianfranco Rossi wanted to document what that means for the island and its roughly 6,000 residents. So he moved to Lampedusa and stayed there for a year and a half and made a documentary about the island called Fire at Sea.
I encountered death just at the border of Europe because some people, they get rescued, but many people died. Just in the last week, 1,000 people died on the attempt to cross the sea from Libya to Lampedusa. As I say, in the last 15 years, more than 20,000 people died. This is one of the biggest tragedies Europe is facing since World War, you know, and it's unacceptable that we know about those tragedies happening every day where kids, women, people lose their life and on the attempt to escape from tragedy, from wars, from anger, from desperation. And the question is why we don't do that effort to go to Libya and create this humanitarian bridge where we know that there's a number of 250,000, 300,000 people ready to lose their life every day.
The documentary follows a 12-year-old boy named Samuele. Why did you choose to make the film through the eyes of a child?
Having a child maybe gave me a lot of freedom not to be so ideological, you know, that a child can be always unaware of all the drama that is there. So I didn't have to be so literal about that. And in a way, the more I was filming him, the more I understood that there was an inner state, inner feeling in within his daily life that was always bring me like almost little metaphor on something, something beyond Lampedusa. The fact that he doesn't know what life is bringing him, the struggle that he has on a daily life, was always taking me somewhere else. Mm. And that became for me almost a coming of age,
yeah,
things like a psychological growth, like a romanzo di formazione, we would say in Italian.
What does, I mean, a 12-year-old sees all this stuff happening around him. How does he interpret it?
In the film, you will see there's no real interaction between the island and the migrants. And this is because it's a fact. The boats of the migrants are now intercepted in the middle of the sea by the military boat. And they are taken into the island with the boat of the Coast Guard. And then they're brought into the port. On the port, there is a bus waiting for them that's going to take them to the identification center, which is in the middle of the island of Lampedusa, completely far away from all kind of daily activities. And then from there are brought into the mainland in Italy, where they start all a journey of being identified, try to see if the refugee status is, can be applied to them, and it becomes really another nightmare for those people. But Lampedusa, somehow, when I arrived there, there's still hope. You know, they touch land, they touch freedom. But also, paradoxically, in these last 4 years, there's not much interaction between the island and Lampedusa just because it's been institutionalized arrival. While before, there were a certain welcoming, people opened their own home, they get clothes, they get food. And now it changed completely. Lampedusa became almost like a metaphor, like Europe somehow, you know, like this microcosm where there's no more interaction between these two worlds and there's a separation besides being in between the institutions.
Gianfranco, Italians who live on the mainland, what kind of impression do they have of Lampedusa and its refugees and what its residents are dealing with?
Most of the people, they leave the problem of immigration just as numbers, you know, it's like 250 die, 500 die, 1,000 die, and there's no, you know, we keep doing our own things on a daily basis without really reflecting that behind any of this number, there's a person, there's a single person with his own his story. And many people, after they went to see the film, thanked me to somehow become aware that the fact that, you know, those numbers are not just numbers, but are people.
Filmmaker Gianfranco Rossi is the director behind the documentary Fire at Sea, about life on the Italian island of Lampedusa, the site of hundreds of thousands of migrant landings over the last two decades. The film will be out here in the States in October. Gianfranco, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Some refugees who make it to the West are heading to Canada. The government there has been relatively welcoming, at least compared to the United States. And Canada has an unusual program that allows local residents to sponsor the resettlement of a refugee family. But when the Syrian refugee crisis hit, the government underestimated how much Canadians would want to help out. Here's Alina Simone reporting from Nelson in British Columbia.
If you're looking for a place that is pretty much the opposite of Syria, you might pick Nelson, a Canadian city of 10,000, about an hour's drive from the Washington state border. Here on the main drag, aside from a guy playing guitar in a cafe patio, you'll find a food co-op, stores selling dream catchers, and a marijuana dispensary, one of five in town. Nelson became a hotbed of progressive politics during the Vietnam War, when U.S. draft dodgers fled here across the border. So it's not a big surprise to learn that Nelson also has three different groups who are sponsoring refugee families, or trying to. Bill Moore, a retired teacher, is the founder of Nelson Friends of Refugees.
In the fall, I began to think about Syrian refugees. I find the situation horrifying and painful, and I thought maybe we could do something, and I reached out to people, and they reached out to people, and here we are.
Moore's motivation for helping bring a Syrian family to Nelson was more personal than political. In his 20s, he spent a month in Syria.
Just backpacking and hitchhiking around. I was young and I just fell in love with it.
So back in November, Moore recruited 15 like-minded people and formed an official constituent group. The Canadian government requires these groups to provide, quote, emotional and financial support for the full sponsorship period, usually a year. Here's Judith Fearing, another member of Nelson Friends of Refugees.
What we provide is some housing, food, clothing, orientation. Basically, we're providing a warm welcome.
Aside from that, they also need to provide money, a lot of money.
$40,000.
Yeah, $40,000. Yeah, so fundraising is an issue.
But by February, they'd managed to raise all that money, gotten a local home donated. They had everything in hand, except a refugee family. 4 months went by.
We have been waiting, yeah.
The bottleneck began last November when Canada launched a fast-track initiative to resettle 25,000 Syrian refugees called the hashtag Welcome Refugees program.
We got some stuff for you.
Tonight they step off the plane as refugees, but they walk out of this terminal as permanent residents of Canada.
That's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcoming Syrian refugees in December. But after officials reached their goal in February, they stopped fast-tracking applications, saying the accelerated pace couldn't be sustained indefinitely. That's left some sponsorship groups in Canada in the lurch, some losing money every month renting empty apartments. Nelson Friends of Refugees didn't have that problem, but...
We talked about, okay, how are we going to keep this group moving if the wait is longer and longer?
One thing they focused on was how to make the Syrians feel more at home once they did arrive, because Nelson differs from Syria in a lot of other ways.
Nelson particularly is fairly white.
According to census data, 92% white.
There's no mosque here.
And practically no Arabic speakers. So the Nelson Friends decided to educate themselves.
Let's just focus on the pa sound.
They recruited Adib Malas, a med student originally from Saudi Arabia, to give them an Arabic lesson. It was, they say, totally fun, but not enough to provide a warm welcome in Arabic.
No. I'm not gonna try and say anything. Other people in our group probably would.
I could say marhaba, which there means hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
The time they've spent waiting also led to some soul-searching about their own expectations. Providing money and help can easily translate into a certain sense of proprietorship, which they wanted to avoid. So one member of the group created a code of ethics.
We don't have any idea what kind of connection we'll have with them. Sometimes people are hoping that it's going to be so pally-pally, and it may not be. And we're still responsible for funding them.
And recently, the group had another revelation. They decided they would accept a refugee family from anywhere, not just Syria.
We just decided that there were a lot of people who needed a home. And it didn't have to be a Syrian family. So just let go and take who comes.
And since they told their sponsorship coordinator they were willing to take anyone from the list.
The movement has begun.
Yeah.
Can't say a lot really right now. It looks like something is going to happen.
That's all I could get out of Bill. After waiting so many months, he wouldn't want to jinx it. For the World, this is Alina Simone from Nelson, British Columbia.
Here in the U.S., Kansas has a long history of welcoming refugee families. Many of them settle in the state's largest city, Wichita. We're talking refugees who fled wars in Congo, Sudan, Iraq, and lots of other places. And they often arrive with kids and teenagers. Reporter Ashley Cleek went to see how the schools in Wichita are adapting.
Isaac Tashime and his sister were born in the Democratic Republic of Congo. One day when they were little, their father was kidnapped by rebels, so their mother fled into the jungle with her two kids. For about 15 months, they lived in the forest. Isaac remembers drinking rainwater from trees and being afraid of wild animals because they'd seen human remains in the forest.
And sometimes we could run into skulls and skeletons of people who were eaten badly, and it was a really tough life. I don't know how we got lucky.
But somehow they did. Isaac's family made it to Uganda, where they waited as refugees for 8 years before being resettled in Wichita. They arrived last January. A week after arriving in the U.S., Isaac and his little sister, Deborah Mahamagisha, were sent off to school.
I was used to my life back then. Now we've changed my life, and it's like something very different.
The language, the mixture of races, the cafeteria food, the way students act towards teachers, it was all totally different. Now, Isaac is a junior and Deborah is a freshman at Wichita East High School, a massive school. In fact, it's the biggest high school in the state with more than 2,000 students. Their journey sounds almost unbelievable, but Melanie Townsend, who runs the Speakers of Other Languages program, has heard it many times.
That's a very common story that we hear from many of our students. Many, if not most, were either born or raised in refugee camps.
Townsend has seen 58 new refugee students enroll in the school in just the past year and a half. She knows all their stories and calls them my kids.
Are you scared? Don't be scared.
No,
it's okay.
While I'm interviewing students, Townsend sits across from them protectively, listening. She says some students have lived in refugee camps for a decade. Some have never had any formal education or even learned how to hold a pencil. Others are dealing with intense trauma and PTSD.
That's a challenge that we have as a school district, is how do we meet those needs? How do we support these students? Because they are challenges that we just haven't experienced before.
Including complicated dynamics among students. Isaac's little sister Deborah says when she was in middle school, kids would yell Congo or Africa at her in the hallway or on the bus. She and other refugee students were accused of stealing books.
They're like singing like, "You're African, you're ugly." I'm like, my heart is just like strong because of the words that my mom told me. So if somebody bullies me, never actually like gets into me. I'm like, just whatever. But I was bullied a lot.
Teachers, please pardon this interruption. We will be having outdoor recess today.
Across town at Coleman Middle School, Principal Jeff Friend deals with a similar population.
Our kids are truly intense. I think people forget and don't understand that.
Friend keeps the candy dish on his desk full because kids and teachers stop by a lot.
You walk the halls here and you kind of walk the halls of the world, so it's much different experience growing up than I had.
The struggles are different, too. This year, his teachers had to figure out how to counsel a 12-year-old student who had been a child soldier.
We don't just teach math. We have to understand psychology and basic hygiene sometimes for kids. And so the needs of our kids are so great.
And while enrollment is up, Friend says, his budget keeps going down. This year, Wichita Public Schools plan to cut around $23 million from their budget of $650 million. Friend worries that'll mean cutting programs that keep refugee kids afloat, like an interpreting service that helps connect parents who don't speak English. And Friend, Townsend, and other school administrators worry that a growing anti-refugee sentiment in Wichita and across the country could trickle down into schools. For Deborah, the kid from Congo, the first year of high school has been great. She likes Shakespeare and this new vegetable, broccoli. And recently, she and her friends performed a dance to a Nigerian pop song at a school concert. Back in Africa, Deborah says, she heard a lot of rumors and promises about how life would be in the U.S.
They tell us that it's a wonderful, you're going to get your own house, a car, and a nice job. Your kids are going to go to school. The only thing that I've seen is going to school, and I like it so much because other things they promise don't happen, but at least the school thing happens.
And for Deborah, school's a pretty great place right now. For The World, I'm Ashley Cleek in Wichita, Kansas.
Bye-bye, Dad. Have a good weekend. Or evening. It's only Thursday. Evening.
You missed it.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We were just talking in the newsroom about how much attitudes toward LGBT issues have changed in the last few years, not just in the U.S., but in many places around the globe, though there are plenty of exceptions. Take the case of Mpho Tutu. She's the daughter of South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the legendary anti-apartheid campaigner and Nobel Peace Prize winner. He's retired now. She was in the church, too, an ordained priest in the Episcopal Church in South Africa, until last month when she was forced to resign.
It was incredibly sad for me.
That's Mpho Tutu speaking earlier this week with our colleagues at the BBC.
I was surprised by how much it hurt, how it landed, because it wasn't unexpected.
Her offense, marrying the person she loved, a Dutch academic, a woman named Marceline van Furth.
Falling in love with Marceline was probably as much a surprise to me as to anyone else. Quite frankly, I'm guessing that I fall more as bisexual on the spectrum than lesbian.
Both Mpho Tutu and her wife are divorced with children, but the Episcopal Church in South Africa doesn't recognize same-sex marriages, so her bishop came to her tearfully to revoke her license as a priest. Tutu decided to give it up instead.
I knew when I married Marceline that there was a chance I would have to give up my license.
Tutu says she's received a lot of support in South Africa. Several of her clergy colleagues offered to resign in protest against the church's action, but she persuaded them not to. Instead, she hopes her case will start a conversation. Her father, Desmond Tutu, has himself long been a champion of choice when it comes to human sexuality. More than once, he said, quote, "I'd rather go to hell than pray to a homophobic God." Mpho Tutu says she has no regrets over her choice.
I have to think of all of the people for whom the choice was, I can be a priest or I can be with the person I love. Always choose love. Everything else will fall into place somehow. When in doubt, just do the most loving thing.
Mpo Tutu Van Firth, that's her married name now, speaking with our colleagues at the BBC earlier this week. Our friend and frequent contributor Beto Arcos was in Colombia 2 months ago. He went there to collect material for stories about the country's music scene today. But one of the artists he really wanted to connect with has actually been on the scene in Colombia for decades. Noel Petro is 80 years old, and he still takes to the stage. It's not an endurance test. Colombians just adore him. In the same way kids love their kooky uncle, you know, the one who asks you to pull his finger. But Beto told me that when he met Noel Petro in Bogota, he found that there is a lot more to the man.
It was one of these meetings where you have this kind of sense of, wow, I'm meeting this legend. He's an amazing character with a lot of personality. And it was. It was true the way that I imagined him. We sat down in this corner little restaurant across the street from where he lives. And the moment you just introduce yourself, he'll start talking without even any questions. It was something else.
Some people in Colombia consider him their Chuck Berry. I know it's kind of about his guitar. What did he tell you about his guitar and why it's so special?
Well, he said that he started getting into music as a kid. And then he heard Los Panchos, this Mexican trio that everybody knows, you know, from the golden age of Mexican cinema. He saw them on a film and saw the way that they were playing the lead guitar, the acoustic lead guitar in boleros. But then he thought, well, I want to be different, you know. So he started doing these riffs, you know, emulating what he had heard on the acoustic guitar, but he was playing the electric guitar. And that's his true invention. That is his genius that nobody had done that before. It's really unique to Colombia.
He's a musician, also a musical innovator. And as you discovered, he's also a bullfighter and sometimes he does both at the same time. How does that work?
Well, he said, you know, a promoter in Bogota told him, hey, you know, people want to see you do both. Why don't you play and do the bullfight? So he says it's uncomfortable. It's kind of awkward. But this is what he told me. This I could not believe this when he said this. I've been gored and I played with a crack in my head and three loose ribs. You know, after the show, they take me to the hospital. But he's laughing when he's saying all of this.
So get to the name, El Burro Mocho. Where does that come from?
El Burro Mocho is a nickname that he got when he was, you know, a teen. He liked it. He thought it was cool. He thought it was cute. He thought it was weird. He picked it up, and that became his nickname. In fact, he even composed a song named El Burro Mocho.
De todos los animales quisiera ser el burro, aunque a la gente parezca a mi gusto un poquitico absurdo. Por carga que me pusieran, de todos modos gozaría, porque un burro bien armado de buenas patas pide la vía.
He's talking about the donkey singing there. That refers back to his nickname, El Burro Mocho. How good is his donkey imitation?
You know, I think about three or four times when I was talking to him, just on his own, without me prompting him, he just said it.
Pa mis amigos de Estados Unidos, le quiero decir que se habla inglés a la perfección. Ya sé decir, oran you, un abrazo de parte de Burro Mocho.
He says, to my friends in the U.S., I want to tell you that now I know how to speak English perfectly. I know how to say orange juice. A big hug from El Burro Mocho. Mom, I'm being successful. Send money for the bus ride.
So here we've got a bullfighter musician who's performed with a crack in his head. He's got a custom guitar sound. What's exactly his stature today in Colombia, Beto? Serious musician, goofy bullfighter with a guitar, or just some kind of unclassifiable novelty in his 80s?
I think he's a serious musician, and not just me. I mean, he is considered by many musicians, including, you know, the band Aterciopelados.
Sure.
They consider him a major figure in music, an innovator. He just happens to be kind of goofy and odd, but he's a serious musician.
Beto Arcos hosts the weekly podcast, The Cosmic Barrio. He's been telling us about a legend in Colombia, a musician named Noel Petro, El Burro Mocho. Beto, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Marco.
Go, Noel. We have a few videos of Noel Petro playing up at our website, including a very tripped out tune called Damaquiel, featuring multiple psychedelic Noel Petros. You've got to see that one. It's over at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. I'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.